So this is the last lecture of the first part of the course. So this is supposed to wrap up the standard model part of the course, where the emphasis has been on, you know, what the standard model is, how it works, how to figure out what the different physical degrees of freedom are and the different physical parameters and how they operate. And we want to end up today by figuring out, ending up the discussion of how to derive the vertices, and which you can then use to figure out what are the allowed or disallowed physical processes and what their probabilities are. Then the next half of the course will be more focused on what are the unresolved puzzles about the standard model, what are the sort of obvious clues that it presents to us that may not yet fully be incorporated, or maybe not at all fully, maybe not at all incorporated into a better model that they clearly hint at, and what are the best ideas about making further progress, and what are the best hopes for further experimental hints from either laboratory or cosmology experiments. But okay, so today we have this last lecture to finish up deriving the vertices and saying at least a bit about the physics of them. So here I'm back to the ordinary standard model Lagrangian, including just the left-handed neutrino, not the right-handed neutrino. We could or could not include the Weinberg term here as a fifth line. So I want to derive the vertices for this Lagrangian. There are just some subtle extra bits to the story when you include neutrinos that I'll mention at the end. Okay, so let's call this for reference line 1, line 2, line 3, and line 4. Okay, and we spent much of the course dissecting this Lagrangian into its, focusing on its quadratic part, the part quadratic in the fields, and figuring out what the massive and massless states were. Now we just want to do the opposite and go line by line and see what are the vertices that appear. What are the terms that are higher than quadratic? So the goal is to plug in the VEV for H. I mean, split H into its VEV piece and the Higgs boson capital H, and then expand out and find the terms that are cubic after we've made this cubic and higher after we've made the substitution. Okay, so let's first look at line 1. The gauge boson kinetic terms. Okay, let's first look at the first term there, the g mu nu times g mu nu term. So g mu nu, A, remember that is partial mu g nu A minus partial nu g mu A, and then minus g times the structure constant FABC times g mu b g nu c. Okay, so if we take that thing and we square it, so if we write out the kinetic term then, g mu nu a, g mu nu a, okay, let's write it out here. That's partial mu g nu a minus partial nu g mu a minus gauge coupling g, oh, I guess this is g3, this is what I've been usually calling g3, times the structure constants for SU3, FABC, g mu b, g nu c, times another term, which is just with the indices all moved around here, partial mu, g nu a minus partial nu g mu a minus g3 times f abc g Let's call it, oh, sorry, these are different dummy indices than these, so let's call it FADE. G mu D, G nu E. Okay, so now, well, we have the square here of a thing which has two parts, this part. So when we take this part times this part, we'll get the quadratic term we had before, so forget about that. We're interested in the other terms that appear. Well, we can get a cubic term when we multiply this term, which is linear in the fields, times this term, which is quadratic in the fields, or, you know, the other, when we're completing the square, the other term, this term quadratic in the fields, and this term linear in the fields. Okay, so we get a cubic term when we expand this out. So when we expand this out, we get quadratic terms, which we're going to ignore for now. And then, okay, cubic term, which looks like, well, what will it be like? It'll involve 3 powers of g, okay, one of which will have a derivative acting on it. Okay, because this term always has a derivative acting on G. Okay, so let's add indices here. Let's write these guys as all having some indices. So call this alpha, space time index alpha, gauge index A, beta B, gamma C, and then let's call the index on the derivative delta. Okay, well, I'm not going to expand it out explicitly, but when we do expand this thing out, we'll find that it's multiplied by, you know, if we just expand this thing out and keep all of these cubic terms in G, we'll find that they're multiplied by some expression, A, which has appropriate indices to soak up all of these indices. So it'll have 4 upper spacetime indices, alpha, beta, gamma, and delta, and 3 lower gauge indices, A, B, C. Okay, so it's some expression just built out of the coupling constants, the indices A, B, C appearing on the structure constants, and then some metric tensors with their indices raised and lowered, so that in order to contract up these indices, these space-time indices in the right way to get them to match the terms that we actually get out of the Lagrangian, which here I've written these indices, alpha, beta, gamma is all separate, but in this actual term, you know, we actually have that these two indices are always contracted up with these two indices in some way. So this thing has the necessary metric tensors to do all of those contractions. So again, I'm not gonna work out explicitly the expression for A here, but it's clear how you would do it. You would just expand this thing, keep the cubic terms, massage the whole thing until you've collected all those cubic terms and written them in this form. And okay, so that thing will give rise to a vertex. Well, since there's 3 G's, it'll have 3 legs, each of which is a G. So it'll have this, it'll have a G A alpha on this leg, and a G B beta on this leg, and a G C gamma on this leg. And then when we go to momentum space, this partial sub delta will act on the Fourier component. When we do a Fourier transform to go to momentum space, we'll rewrite this thing, this field, instead of being a function of space-time, we'll read it as function of momentum times e to the I k dot x. So this thing will bring down a factor of I k sub delta. And so we have over here the momentum associated with this leg, k sub delta. okay, and so the expression, the Feynman diagram, the amplitude associated with this diagram will just be, well, it's always just I times the relevant term in the Lagrangian with the fields removed. Okay, so here we have I times this expression, whatever it is. This is an expression that's independent of the field. It's just made from some constants, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, A, B, C. And then we'll get an I k sub delta from that derivative. Okay, so that's how you would derive, that's the vertex involving three gluons. And then, we're not done yet, there's also another term we haven't written down yet, which is the quartic term that comes from multiplying this quadratic term times this quadratic term. Okay, so there's a quartic term. And in the same way as we did here, well, we can just write that as some general expression. It's going to involve four g's, g alpha a, g beta b, g gamma c, g delta d. And again, I'm not going to work out explicitly what the coefficient of that is, but it's some expression. I just want you to understand the logic. It's clear that you could just as a little exercise work out what the expression is, but it's multiplied by some expression, bunch of constants that carry the appropriate indices to contract up all of these indices and make a scalar. So it's multiplied by some expression, b with indices alpha, beta, gamma, delta up here, and indices a, b, c, d. Okay, and so this guy, maybe I'll write it over here, just like this guy gave rise to a three gluon kinetic term. This guy over here will give rise to a four-legged vertex. Sorry, just as that one gave rise to a three-legged vertex, I meant to say. This guy, because it's a term with four g's in it, will give rise to a kinetic term like this, where if we multiply the, if we label the external legs by the corresponding gluons, g alpha a, g beta b, g gamma c, and g delta d, then the vertex, the amplitude associated with this vertex will just be I times whatever expression we derived here. So it'll just be I times B alpha beta gamma delta A B C D. Okay? So much for the first term on the first line. Let's proceed to the other two terms on the second line and see what we can find. Okay, so here we're getting the, so just for the people who were coming from Jaume's lecture, just to briefly recap, I just want to derive now for you all of the, higher than cubic terms. I'm just trying to present, I'm not going to be able to I don't have time to explicitly derive the exact expressions for all of the vertices, but I want you to see where they all come from and understand, how you would derive them, including the exact coefficients of each vertex if you did it in principle. So we're going line by line here and calculating all of the cubic and higher terms after we plug in the expression little h is equal to vev plus capital H. And so far we've just looked at the first term on line one and seen that there's, when you expand it out, there's a cubic and quartic term in capital G. And by expanding out those two expressions, I haven't explicitly written them, but the coefficient of the cubic term is this capital A with some indices, and so that's, so I times that is the thing that appears next to the cubic vertex for involving three gluon legs, and correspondingly the quartic term is proportional to some coefficient G with some upper indices and lower indices, and the four leg vertex is proportional to I times that, is given by I, the amplitude is given by I times that. Okay, so now let's proceed. So this is line one continued. Okay, so what will happen with the rest of line one? Well, we have no cubic terms coming from the B's because remember that that's a U1 gauge field. So the structure constants vanish, and so the extra term in that we had in G mu nu involving the structure constants for SU3 is not present for B mu nu. Okay, so really we're getting all the cubic and higher terms are all the interaction terms are coming from the W mu nu guy, and in principle they're of the same basic type as for the gluons. There's a three-legged vertex involving the W's and a four-legged interaction involving the W's. But remember that the W's are not the physical fields we want to work with. We want to rewrite, you know, before we actually interpret those cubic and quartic terms as vertices, we want to rewrite them in terms of the physical fields, the W plus minus, the Z, and the photon gamma. And so I remind you, so we would just, what you would do is you would just expand out, you would look, you would isolate the cubic and quadratic terms involving W, mu, nu, 1, 2, and 3 there, just like we did for the gluons. But then you would substitute W, mu, you would rewrite W, mu, 1, 2, and 3 in terms of Z, the gamma, the photon, and W plus minus. Okay, so remember that goes like the Z mu and the photon gamma mu are related by the Weinberg matrix, by the Weinberg angle. So we have this some matrix cosine theta W, sine theta W, minus sine theta W, cosine theta W, that arose, okay, times W mu 3 and B mu. And then we also have W mu plus minus, which is given by 1 over root 2 W mu 1 plus or minus I times W mu 2. Okay, so using these expressions, we can rewrite all the cubic terms, cubic and higher terms in the first line in terms of the W's and Z and gamma. And so in principle, you're just following the same steps as we did for the gluons, plus this extra substitutions at the end, and then picking out the terms. But here I just want to, again, not do that on the board. I just want to emphasize which kinds of vertices you get, which kinds of vertices are non-zero. Okay? And basically, the way you can think about it is that, well, what will you get? You'll get, just like for the G's, you'll get terms with four legs and terms with three legs. But then, after you do this substitution, the ones that will remain non-zero are the ones that conserve charge. Okay? So, in other words, so let's say we wanted to write down let's say we wanted to figure out what were the three external leg, the three-legged vertices involving vectors. Well, here's one that we could write down. Okay, two W's and the photon gamma. Okay, that one is legal because here we have a W coming in, carrying charge plus one into the vertex, and another W carrying charge plus one out of the vertex. So there's no net overall charge flowing into or out of the vertex. So charge will be conserved in any process that involves this vertex. Now, this vertex ends up not being a source or sink for electric charge, because if this guy carries a charge, every time this guy carries a charge in, this guy carries another charge out. And this guy doesn't carry any charge. Okay, so that's an example of an allowed vertex. So we'll get one like that. And again, you could work out, just by the same process I described, you could work out the exact amplitude associated with that guy. Another one that would be allowed would where we have two W's again. To conserve charge, and then to conserve charge, again, this guy has to be a neutral guy. So it could also be a Z. Now you might ask, are there any other three-legged these are the only three-legged vertices we can write down. You can't write down one with three W's because that wouldn't conserve charge. You won't write down one with three gammas because it's a U1 gauge boson. So a U1 gauge boson, again, doesn't have it, this is associated with U1 electromagnetism. So it doesn't have an associated it doesn't carry any charge, doesn't carry any gauge charge of its own, and so it's not associated with any so its field strength does not have, it just has these terms. Okay, it doesn't have the extra commutator terms vanish. Okay. Same goes for Z. Z is a completely uncharged boson, just like gamma. So its field strength has only these terms. Its kinetic term, its field strength has only these terms, not these terms. It's different in the sense that it also has a mass term, but from the standpoint of its field strength, it doesn't have these higher terms, and so we don't get a gamma 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 vertex, and we don't get a z z z vertex. Okay, so these are the only two three-legged diagrams involving the electroweak bosons. What about four-legged diagrams? Well, now we could get one that involves four W's. You'll find that you get one with four W's. Okay, again, and with two of the charges flowing in and two of the charges flowing out to conserve electric charge. So we get four W's. Now, of course, we can't get three W's because that wouldn't conserve charge. We could get two W's. So we can get one with two W's flowing in, one W coming in, one W whose charge is coming out. And then to conserve charge, this thing over here, this already conserves charge. So the other two legs had better also conserve charge. So one way to do that would be to have two Z's here. Another way to do it would be to have two gammas, so we could have two photons. Another way to do it is to have one photon and one Z. Okay, and that's it, involving two W's. And then we could say, well, maybe we could have zero W's and just make a four-legged vertex out of gammas and Z's. Well, no, actually, you'll find when you do the expansion and rewrite in terms of W and Z and gamma, you'll find you don't find any four-legged vertices that just involve gammas and Z's. Just like over here, you didn't find any three-legged vertices that just involved gammas and Z's, because the gammas and Z's are each U1 bosons, that uncharged bosons, so they just don't have the extra commutator term in their field strength to give rise to any vertices like this on their own. Okay, so those two three and four-legged vertices for the gluons, these two three-legged vertices for the electroweak bosons, and these four four-legged vertices for the electroweak bosons are all the vertices we get from line one. Okay? What about line two? Well, in line two, again, all we're doing is we're plugging little h is equal to v plus capital H into line two, expanding out and isolating the cubic and quartic terms, anything higher than quadratic. Well, we're not going to get anything cubic or higher from this term, if you think about it. But from this term, we will. We'll get when we plug this in, we'll get both a cubic term in capital H, and then because every term in here is some product of four H's, and we could either in each of those little H's, we could now replace it by a V or a capital H. If we replace all the little h's by cap, we get a term for each of those possibilities. So if we take all the little h's and replace them by capital H's, we get a quartic term. So this is coming from line two now. If we replace all of the little h's by capital H's, we get a four-legged vertex. The Higgs interacts like that. And then alternatively, we could replace one of the little h's by a v and the rest by a capital H. And so in that way, we would get, okay, and so this guy will have a coupling constant, which is just I times the coupling constant of the quartic term, so I times lambda over 4. But then we'll also get that cubic term I just mentioned. Okay, which you can work out the exact coupling, but it's going to be basically, there's going to be the coupling constant lambda coming from that term in the Lagrangian, And then, because we replace one of the little h's by a v, it will also look like a coefficient in front of this term. So we'll get something like that, and then times I. And then there will be some factors, numerical factors here, because we included, there's several terms of that form. Okay, so that's everything we get from the potential, because once we substitute more than two of the little h's with a v, two or more of the little h's with the v here, we're back to quadratic terms that we already dealt with earlier. Okay, but so we're still not done with line two. We have to look at these terms here. So remember d mu h. Well, remember h was a singlet under SU3, but it was charged under SU2 and U1. So when we expand this out, this is some partial mu times h, and then plus I g1 times the hypercharge of this field, 1/2, times the identity matrix, times the 2x2 identity matrix, times b mu, plus e2 times one of the three polysig times the generator for SU2, which we learned was the 1/2 times the poly sigma matrix in our normalization, times W mu A, where we're summing now over the three poly sigma matrices and times the three W mu's here. Okay, so each of these terms, this really involves a 2x2 identity matrix here. Let me call that I sub 2, how about the 2x2 identity matrix. So each of these things is a 2x2 matrix acting on this two component field little h. So now when we do the business where we plug in little h is v plus capital H. So now we see this term involves some terms that are linear in the fields. There's this term which is linear in the fields, and there's these terms times v, which are also linear in the fields. But when we take these terms times capital H, those terms are quadratic in the field. And so again, when we square this term, we'll get cubic and quartic terms coming from the square when we take these. So just to be clear about what I mean, so that the quadratic terms here, so schematically, when we plug in v plus capital H here, we'll get a term that's like, okay, that linear term. I'm just dropping the 1 over 2 because I'm not trying to be precise about any of the numbers here, but and then this expression. So when we square this, we'll get cubic terms coming from the linear term here hitting the quadratic term coming from this times this. Why am I doing such a bad job of my board abilities have fallen apart here. I don't know how to write this in a way that's quick but also clear. So basically the same expression here. Okay, daggered. These are details. Just trying to let you see exactly what terms appear. So we get cubic terms from this linear term hitting the quadratic term we get from this times capital H, and also, of course, this linear term hitting the quadratic term we get from this times capital H. So when you expand that out, if you do the exercise, what do you find there? Well, you get the only terms you find are a term where H talks to two vector bosons. And again, it has to conserve charge So since this has charge zero, these two guys had better add up to charge zero. So what are the possibilities here? Well, you could have a W coming in and out, conserve charge, or you could have a Z coming in and out. Okay, those are the only two cubic terms you get involving H and two, the only two cubic terms you get from line two. You might ask, wouldn't it also conserve charge to have an H and two photons? And yes, it would. But those don't appear because you may remember earlier in the class when we were trying to work out what the photon was, it was the unbroken generator. It was we had this four-dimensional vector space of the electroweak bosons, B and the three W's. And we worked out that a one-dimensional subspace of that three-dimensional space annihilated this vector. So there was some one-dimensional subspace of these matrices that gave zero when acting on this. Well, that's exactly the photon. That one-dimensional linear combination is exactly the photon. So we're not going to get, for that reason, we're not going to get any non-zero terms involving the photon when we expand this thing out. Okay? So those are the only two cubic terms. What about the quartic terms? The quartic terms come from when we multiply these gauge boson terms times the capital H part of this, times these gauge boson terms times the capital H part of this. So again, if you just work that out and see what are the non-zero terms that appear, well, again, now you can probably guess the answer. So now we're taking two terms involving capital H. So we get two legs that are H's. And these are both charge neutral, so we have to do the other two legs also have to be charge neutral. So the two possibilities are the same as here. We get two W's coming out in such a way as to conserve charge, or two Z's. Okay, so that's everything you can get from line two. Okay? You can get two self-interactions of the Higgs, two cubic terms involving a Higgs and two vectors, and two quartic terms involving two Higgs and two vectors. Okay, again, no other ones involving gammas because gamma dropped out of this whole expression, dropped out of that whole line. Okay, great. Now we're making progress. Line three. Well, you see, what happens with line three? Every term in line three has the same basic form. It's some fermion bar times a covariant derivative times a fermion. And so if we expand that out, that's fermion bar times the partial derivative slash, and then plus I times some gauge bosons slash. Well, this is let me use A as my term for generic gauge bosons. Times some gauge boson A mu times gamma mu times F. Okay, so the term coming from this times this times this, that was the quadratic term for the fermions that we already dealt with when we were working with the quadratic part of the Lagrangian. So the cubic terms now come from this term times this term times this term. Okay, so they all have the basic form that there are three-legged, everything coming from line three is a three-legged vertex involving this field, the gauge boson A, on one external line, and then a fermion coming in, and a fermion going, and the same fermion going out. Okay, well, by same, let's see, I have to talk a little bit more about that. Okay, but so let's be a little bit more specific. What more particularly, what gauge boson terms appear here, of course, depends on what the field is and what charges it carries. Okay, so if F is a quark field, then one of the gauge bosons appearing here will be the corresponding gluon field, because this guy, a quark field, transforms in the non-trivial triplet representation of SU3. So we'll have a 3x3 gluon field appearing here. And so for any quark field, we'll have a version of this vertex which looks like the quark, when f is equal to a quark, we'll have the quark with color A. So now this is the triplet index that runs from 1, 2, 3. This is the three-component vector when I display its SU3 index. So this guy, the quark of charge A, will come in, emit or absorb a gluon, and turn into a quark of charge B. And the gauge and the gauge boson that hits it here will carry, you know, if this in order to convert this guy from a quark of charge A to a quark of charge B, the gauge boson, if we interpret it as coming into the vertex, will be a gauge boson with color that carries the colors B and anti-A. So the anti-A comes in and annihilates the incoming A here, and the B gives rise to the B of the B color of the outgoing quark. So in other words, the component of G, if we think of G as a 3x3 matrix, the component of G that acts on this will be the AB component of the matrix G mu AB of G mu. Okay. So fine. So and then there'll be a coupling constant here that's proportional to G3, because that's the coupling constant that appears in front of the gluon here. Okay. Over here, if we now another term when we expand this out, again, I won't do the exercise on the board, but again, what you're it's just a matter of writing down all the terms. We wrote down the complete kinetic terms for each of these guys before, and so we've already dealt with the gluon terms, which appear in front of the quarks. But now, for the other fields, if it's a left-handed field, then it will also have W1, 2, and 3s appearing here. And if it has a hypercharge, if it has a non-zero hypercharge, it'll have a B mu appearing here. And then, as before, we want to rewrite all of those W's and B's, those four vectors, in terms of the four physical vectors, Z, gamma, W plus, and W minus, and read off the coefficients of the non-zero terms that remain here. And so, an exercise which I unfortunately don't have time to do on the board, but which is a nice exercise to do, is to check that if you look at the coefficient of f bar times gamma times f, it's always proportional to the electromagnetic coupling constant times the electric charge of this particular field f. Okay, so for any fermion in the standard model, we have a diagram like this, where the fermion comes in, the exact same fermion comes out, and it emits or absorbs a photon like this. And the coupling constant here is proportional to the electromagnetic coupling, which is the same for all fields, but then times the particular electric charge of that field. So let's call that capital Q sub F. So for the electron, this would be minus one, but for the up quark, this would be for let's say the right-handed up quark, this would be plus 2/3. Okay, this depends on what fermion comes in and out. Okay, and then finally, again, we're still rewriting these four electroweak gauge bosons in terms of the four physical gauge bosons, Z, gamma, W plus minus. And so the only two we have left to deal with are Z and W plus minus. So what do you find there? Well, Z and W plus minus, crucial point is that they only talk to the left-handed parts of the fermions. So for any fermion that comes in, for any left-handed fermion, because those are the guys that transform under SU2, we end up finding a coupling to Z and W. Okay. The coupling to Z is actually universal for all of the left-handed fermions in the standard model. And the coupling to W, the only difference there is that, remember, these left-handed guys came in a doublet. So if we, let me see, what's the notation? So, I've been trying to stick to the notation where I write the massive vector bosons as a dashed one. So sorry, that should be a dash C, and this should be a dash W. So if we have a W coming into this guy, the only thing is that it still talks only to the left-handed fermions, but now because W is a combination of W1, you know, W plus minus here, this boson was a linear combination of W mu 1 and W mu 2. Okay, but remember W mu 1 and W mu 2 originally appeared here multiplied by the Pauli sigma matrices sigma 1 and sigma 2, which are the two off-diagonal Pauli sigma matrices. Okay, so whereas B and Z were both multiplying B, gamma and Z, explain this better, sorry. So when we expand out the electroweak part of this, if there's a gamma and Z appearing here, they came from a linear transformation from the guys B and W3. Okay, but this guy was multiplying the identity matrix, which is diagonal, and this guy was multiplying the Pauli sigma matrix sigma 3, which is also diagonal. That's the one that has a 1 in the upper diagonal and a minus 1 in the lower diagonal and zeros in the off diagonal. Okay, because these two guys are both multiplying diagonal SU2 2 by 2 generators, it means that those terms, the terms involving gamma and Z, don't induce any coupling between the upper component here and the lower component here. The upper component here only gets coupled to the upper component here. The lower only gets coupled to the lower component here. Okay, so that's why if, for example, I have here a down quark coming in, I get a down quark coming out. I don't get an up quark coming out. And here also, if I get a down left coming in, I get a down left coming out. I don't get an up left. With the W's, it's the opposite. The W boson, W plus minus, came from W1 and W2, which are both multiplying off-diagonal Pauli sigma matrices, purely off-diagonal. So they're the opposite. They only couple the up guy here to the lower component of this. You know, if I think of this as a 2 by 2, a two-component vector, it's only the upper component here that gets coupled to the lower component here, and it's only the lower component that gets coupled to the upper component here. So, in other words, if W comes in and I have an up-left guy coming in here, sorry, let me make that a up-left comes in, I want up left comes in, then to conserve charge, I get a down left coming out. So now this guy comes in with charge plus 2/3, this guy carries away a unit of charge, and so this guy comes out with charge minus 1/3. Or that's what happens with the quarks. With the leptons, it's the analogous thing. If a new left comes in with charge 0, this guy carries away a charge plus 1, and so we're left with a charge minus 1 state here, E left. Okay, so those are the only vertices we get from line 3. Okay, just that the each of the four forces, if you want, talking to the fermions.
Why do you say z omega to the left hand fermion?
Sorry?
Why z omega to the left hand?
Yeah, if you expand this guy out, yeah, the right-handed guy
doesn't z has a component of b?
Sorry?
Isn't z has part of the b in it? Made of w3 is b. W3 is certainly only possible to the left-handed guy.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I'm doing this wrong. Sorry. Okay. In view of time, let me sort that out at the end. I admit I'm a little bit confused about that, and it's conceivable that I said that wrong, but I don't. Well, can I leave that to the end? All right. I'm going to try to resist thinking about that now, and then come back to that at the end. Okay, finally, line 4. One more thing I want to say about line 3. Is that one other important thing to say here is that if you look at the if you look at these gauge boson terms, they connect. They don't change the generation of the field. Okay, so if this was a down quark of the first generation coming in, it would get changed, and it was, let's say, red, you know, A equals 1, it would get changed to a down quark of the first generation also here. The only thing that would change would be its color. But the type of quark and the generation wouldn't change. Okay. Here also nothing changes, including the generation. So if a first generation guy comes in here, a first generation down quark comes in here, a first generation down quark comes out here. It doesn't get changed into a strange or something like that. Same thing here. But here something else happens. Which is that, so here, the first generation up quark goes to the first generation down quark in the sense that these two ups and downs live in the same first generation left-handed, you know, in our table when we were writing down the standard, when we've always been writing down the standard model Lagrangian, we've been writing it in terms of the left-handed quark doublet, and these are just the upper and lower components of that field. U left and D left when we show the SU2 index explicitly. But then remember that in order to write down the mass eigenstates, because of the extra factor VCKM appearing here, we had to absorb VCKM into the down left here. So we defined a new field down left prime, which was the mass eigenstate, which was part of the mass eigenstate. So when we wrote down the mass eigenstate for D, it was a Dirac fermion whose upper component was D right and whose lower component was not D left, but was D left prime, which was related to D left by the CKM matrix. Okay? So as a consequence, an important thing is that this is the only one of these vertices that changes that's so-called flavor changing, that changes a guy from one generation into a guy from a different generation. Because here we had a first generation U getting turned into a first generation D, but then the first generation D is VCKM IJ times the jth generation. You know, if we rewrite this in terms of the mass eigenstate, okay, we may get out a first generation D, but then when we rewrite in terms of the mass eigenstates, we get a linear combination of all three mass eigenstates appearing here. So actually there's an amplitude for any fermion that comes in to emit a W and get converted into the core, any uptype fermion, U or nu, comes in and gets converted into any one of the three low downtype fermions, D or E, of any of the three generations, with an amplitude proportional to VCKM IJ. Okay, that's the amplitude for, you know, a charm quark to go to a down quark. Charm quark is second generation. Down quark is down quark is first generation. So that would be proportional to VCKM 2-1, for example. Okay. And sorry, one last thing to say is that so that in the pure standard model, I got ahead of myself. In the pure standard model, that we only had the CKM matrix for quarks. So we only have this issue where there's an amplitude for a generation two quark to a generation two fermion to go to a generation one fermion. That only happens for quarks in the pure standard model. So if there were no masses for the neutrinos. But then we said that either in the neutrinos in the standard model effective field theory or in the new standard model augmented by right-handed neutrinos, we need to go to one of those models to explain neutrino masses. But then as soon as we do that, we found that, well, without neutrino masses, we were able to completely diagonalize this matrix. But now, as we saw in the previous two lectures, in the presence of neutrinos, we can't completely diagonalize this sector. And any way you look at it, we're left with an undiagonalizable part, which again leads to an analogous issue that now in the standard convention, we still diagonalize this guy's Yukawa coupling, so we still diagonalize little y sub e. But then this guy is still related by some matrix U. So this guy, the ith left-handed neutrino, is related by some matrix U ij to the jth light neutrino mass eigenstate. This matrix is analogous to the CKM matrix, and it's usually called the PMNS matrix, again, after the discoverers of this fact. Those are the initials of the people who discovered it. But so the bottom line is that what happens is that, for example, if a electron in the sun, you know, if a neutrino gets produced due to nuclear reactions in the sun, well, those nuclear reactions are ultimately coming from the electrons rattling around in the sun, so and the weak interactions, they're being produced by this kind of diagram. So what immediately emerges from the sun is a neutrino of type E, an electron type neutrino. In other words, the one that's in the pair with the electron mass eigenstate. But then because of this matrix, that electron neutrino that gets produced by the sun is a linear combination of three different neutrino mass eigenstates, and those things oscillate and beat against each other on their way to the Earth. And so once they get to the Earth is no longer a pure electron neutrino, but because of the interference has has converted, has oscillated into some linear combination of nu e, nu mu, and nu tau by the time it reaches the Earth. That's just a very brief, I don't mean that to be a fully comprehensible explanation, but just in view of time, I just wanted to mention that the analogous thing to the CKM matrix in the lepton sector, due to this diagram, is what causes neutrino oscillations. So that's what neutrino oscillations and neutrino masses come hand in hand in that respect. So finally, I just wanted to mention that we only have one sort of diagram left, which is, in a sense, the easiest, which is that, okay, so every time we have, some guy in the final line, it gives rise to a diagram like, every term in the final line gives rise to a diagram where the Higgs boson couples to a Dirac fermion and its antifermion. And now the coupling is always proportional to, in this case, the coupling constant is always proportional to the mass of the fermion. Why is that? So that you can see without having, it's a good exercise to go through and check that, but the quick way to see that without having to do any calculation is just that, so how did we extract the masses in the final line? Well, we just took we took little h and replaced it by v plus h everywhere, and then we kept the v part. Now we're just doing the okay. We kept the v part, and then we had to do some diagonalizing and so forth to make things maybe to get things into their mass eigenstates. But the point is that now if we just do the same thing but replace but substitute h and then do all the same diagonalizing, well, the only thing that's changed is changing the constant v to the field h. So as a consequence, the same diagonalization process that leads to that led us to be able to write the last term, the quadratic terms in the last term, as a bunch of Dirac mass matrices, Dirac mass terms, like for example a term like this. Well, the only thing that where m sub d was equal to v over root 2 y sub d, the only thing that'll be different now will be that this term will be, instead of m sub d times v over root 2, instead of being y sub d times v over root 2, it'll be y sub d times h over root 2. Okay, so instead of this, we'll get h over root 2 times the matrix y sub d times d d bar d. Okay, so this is what I mean, that the coupling constant and the mass are both determined by the same matrix y sub d. The only difference is that here it's appearing as a dimensionless coupling constant. Here we're multiplying it by the VEV to get the mass. So that's an important prediction of the standard model. We know the masses of all the fermions, and we know the VEV, so we can predict a priori, by dividing this thing by V, we can predict what the Yukawa coupling is in this diagram for each fermion. It's just proportional to the mass of that fermion. So the top quark, which is by far the most massive fermion, is predicted to couple by far the most strongly by its Yukawa coupling to the Higgs boson, etc. And so far, we've only been able to test that prediction for the very heaviest couple of fermions, because they have the strongest coupling, so it's the easiest to test. But so far, the standard model has passed that test, and I think there's every reason to believe that it will pass it for the lighter guys as that becomes experimentally accessible. Okay, The final, very final word, so there we go. Those are all the vertices in the standard model. So in principle, now you can go through and figure out what processes are possible and not possible by just asking which of these vertices can I link up to make an allowed diagram, which ones can't I? You know, for any given process, you just have to ask, can I build a corresponding diagram with those in particles and out particles by gluing together these vertices that we've written down? And if you can, then it's allowed. And if you can't, then it's not allowed. So I had to make some choices about what, given the rush of the final lecture for part one, what to say and what not to say. And so in addition to that, I just wanted to make one final point, which I would be remiss if I left you without, which is that, okay, so we started with this theory. It had three different gauge groups, SU3 times SU2 times U1. We found that those got converted into physical vector bosons, Z, gamma, W plus, W minus, and the gluons. So why is it that in the macroscopic world we only see electromagnetism? Okay, so why is it that we only see a force caused by the photon gamma mu? Where are the forces coming from the other guys? Why do we only see them microscopically? Well, there's one answer for the W's and the Z's, okay, which is that they are massive. Okay, so there's a general fact about bosonic fields that they mediate a force, which in four dimensions is the potential that they generate between two particles that couple to, between any two particles that couple to this field, in four dimensions, the photon generates a potential between those, which is proportional to 1 over r, the distance between them. But if the particle, it could be vector or scalar, is massless, then the corresponding potential gets modified by an exponential factor, which is proportional to the mass of this particle. So this is the mass of the W or the Z. So since the mass of the W or Z is huge, this exponential completely dies away if r gets bigger than the Compton wavelength of the Z or W. So this potential just gets crushed. You can only feel this force on distances r less than 1 over m, less than the Compton wavelength of these bosons. On distances greater than that, the potential is exponentially suppressed, and so the force is exponentially suppressed. So that's why you don't see the weak force at long wavelengths. What about the strong force? Well, now there's a different answer, which is something that we'll talk about later in the course when we talk about the running of couplings in an effective field theory. So the point is that the coupling constant, the gauge coupling constant for the SU3, unlike the other gauge coupling constants, as you go to lower and lower energies, or in other words, to longer, as you look at physical processes on longer and longer wavelengths, this guy gets bigger and bigger at low momenta, or in other words, at large distances. And eventually it gets so big that the theory becomes strongly coupled, and there's a phenomenon called confinement which happens. So, which is to say that there's an observed phenomenon which is qualitatively understood but not really quantitatively understood or understood in any rigorous sense, but which appears to be a fact about the universe, which is that at sufficiently large length scales, SU3 becomes confined because this gauge coupling constant becomes sufficiently big. And as a consequence, at sufficiently large length scales, you can't see any particles that carry any non-trivial SU3 charge. You can only see things that don't transform or are singlets under SU3. So for example, you can't see a free gluon. We've never seen a free gluon in nature. Or you also can't see a free quark like the up quark. You can see three, if these are the SU3 indices, you can see three quarks, UA, UB, and let's say DC, because you can take those three indices and contract them with the invariant epsilon tensor for SU3, and this thing is now invariant. So one thing you can make is a combination of three quarks. That's a singlet under SU3. That's called a baryon. Another thing you can make is a combination of a quark and an antiquark, where you just contract their two SU3 indices like this. This is an SU3, and this guy transforms, you know, if this guy transforms with a SU3 unitary 3x3 U, this guy transforms with U dagger, and so they cancel. So this guy's a singlet. So you can get a quark antiquark pair. This thing is called a meson. And so this is, you don't see free quarks at large distances. You only see these quarks and mesons. So that's why you also you can't see gluon fields over large distances either, because gluons are confined. Okay, so this is why you don't see free quarks, and why you don't see the strong force operating at distances larger than the scale at which this theory becomes strongly coupled and confinement sets in. Okay, so because I know you guys have to make it to lecture at 1, I think maybe I should finish there. I know this last lecture was a rush. I apologize, but I just wanted to make a relatively clean separation between the two pieces of the class. So in view of time, maybe why don't I figure out right after the lecture with Gong whether I made a mistake about Z or not, and then if I did, I'll email a correction. That seem reasonable? And anyone has questions, go for it.